Welcome back. In the previous two lectures, we saw how the Romans increasingly found themselves performing the role of peacemaker in their dealings with the Greeks, which they did, by and large, by exercising restraint, to the point when Flamininus liberated, in quotes, the Greeks who had formerly been under Macedonian rule, a moment that I called the high point of political Philhellenism. In this lecture, we're going to turn our attention to an aspect of Roman life that underwent profound reshaping quite early on as a result of contact with Hellenism, namely religion. We tend today to think of religion as an expression of national identity. Here, contrastingly, we will see the Romans consciously, deliberately, and persistently borrowing from other Mediterranean religions, primarily from the Greeks. Greek religion first began to influence Roman religion in the monarchical period, perhaps as early as 600 BC, and it continued to do so right through the Republican period and beyond. The influence was particularly pronounced when the Roman state came under threat because that produced a crisis of confidence. It was so profound that in 217 BC, as we shall see, Greek and Roman religion essentially became the same. A word about terminology. Our word religion derives from the Latin word religio, which means dread of the supernatural, religious awe. Its connection with what we understand by religion is therefore somewhat tangential. There wasn't any word in either Greek or Latin which incorporated the full range of ideas that we ascribe to religion, largely perhaps because religion wasn't seen as a separate department of life in the way that we separate the secular from the religious. In fact, one of the challenges to an investigation of the Greek and Roman religious systems is the fact that there are very few linguistic equivalents. One point to make clear from the start, however, is that in both societies, what we call religion permeated both of them in ways that appear very strange to us today. I'd like to begin by making three introductory points that are pertinent to virtually all Mediterranean religious systems: Egyptian, Sumerian, Assyrian, Babylonian, Phoenician, etc., as well as Greek and Roman. To begin with, all are polytheistic. The sole exception is Judaism, which made the supreme effort of replacing polytheism, the belief in many gods, with monotheism, the belief in the one God. But even Judaism presupposes a polytheistic environment with which, at least in its early days, it had to make some accommodation. The first commandment states, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." That statement only makes sense in a polytheistic environment, since it permits the worshippers of Yahweh to continue, to some degree, to revere what are perceived as minor gods. Second, Baal, Ishtar, Astarte, the 12 Olympian deities, and indeed the Yahweh of the Book of Exodus, are all, without exception, vengeful and vindictive. Third, if you want a god to do anything for you, then you have to give something in return. Cicero summed this up in three words: do ut deis, I give in order that you, understand deity, give. You might sacrifice a cake, or a chicken, or 100 oxen, or you could dedicate a figurine or a statue, or even, as a community, you could dedicate a temple, commonly in fulfillment of a vow. The most common form of worship, however, was sacrifice, which happens, incidentally, to be one of the words for which there is no exact equivalent in either Greek or Latin. The Latin word sacrificium, which gives us sacrifice means that which has been made sacred, or indeed that which has been made cursed, taken out of the range of the secular, as we might say. Again, so sacrificium is not an exact equivalent to sacrifice. Just an aside here, the major carbohydrate intake of all Mediterranean cultures derive from cereals, predominantly barley and wheat. So the big state-funded sacrifices with, say, 100 head of oxen served as the only occasions when the poor got to eat meat. Next, I want to suggest 10 things that the Greek and Roman religious systems shared in common. Number one, being polytheistic, they were unstable, by which I mean that new cults were constantly entering the pantheon while others were dying out. Two, there was no particular set of beliefs, since there was no agreed doctrine as such, nor any official view of what either system was about. No equivalent, for instance, to the Christian creed. Number three, there was very little intolerance of other systems of belief, though there was intolerance, if that's the right word, of monotheism, because monotheism challenged the authority of the polis, in the case of the Greeks, and of the emperor, in the case of the Romans, because the emperor was regarded as a god. Number four, there was no denial of worldly pleasures. Number five, there was no concept of conversion in the Christian sense of the word. Number six, there was little notion of sin or redemption. Number seven, there was no fear of eternal damnation. Number eight, there was a belief in the power of predictability through portents, through flights of birds, through inspections of entrails, which could tell you something about what lay ahead. Number nine, the main objective of religious observance was about succeeding in this life. And finally, number 10, there was no centralized hierarchy equivalent to a church with deacons, bishops, archbishops, etc. Though having said that, the Roman system did present opportunities for the exercise of religious authority by one individual, namely the Pontifex Maximus, the chief pontiff, the foremost religious officer of the Roman state, and one who was elected for life. It was he who presided over the College of Pontiffs, originally 9 in number, eventually increased to 16, which administered the Jus Divinum, the sacred law that regulated relations between men and gods. The pontifex also had control over the Vestal Virgins, who tended Rome's sacred hearth, and over the flamens, the priests of individual gods. Let's now look at two important differences between Greek and Roman religion. First, Roman religion was in origin animistic and always retained something of that aspect. That is to say, the early Romans didn't believe in deities as such, but rather in vague noumena, a Latin word meaning divine powers that had very precise functions, but no real physical identity. There was, for instance, a spirit which presided over the grain when it lay underground, another spirit to which the Romans prayed when the grain was above ground, and a third which presided over the grain after it had been collected and stored, and so on and so forth. All this was in sharp contrast both to Greek religion and, incidentally, to Etruscan religion, both of which were anthropomorphic. That's to say, they were based on the belief that powerful gods and goddesses of human shape, with human desires and human frailties, presided over the created world. In other words, these gods were immanent, not transcendent deities. They had not created the world, and neither had they existed eternally from the beginning of time, though they were immortal. The principal Greek gods were the Olympians, a not-so-happy, even dysfunctional, one might say, extended family that lived on Mount Olympus in northern Greece, constantly squabbling with one another, because it's a feature of polytheistic systems that the gods are perennially jealous of one another, jealous in particular of the favors and attention that they receive from us poor mortals. It was through contact with both the Etruscans and the Greeks that Roman religion became more anthropomorphic, although animism still persisted in the remoter regions of Italy. I shall talk more specifically about Etruscan religion in a moment. The second difference is this. It's difficult to pin down in any precise way, but it seems that the Romans were more punctilious in their religious observances than the Greeks. Dionysius of Halicarnassus, a Greek historian writing in the time of Augustus, says that it was due to the immense piety of the Romans that they were so successful in their wars. Unlike the Greeks, the implication is, who were rather sloppy in their worship and who paid the price by being regularly drubbed by the Romans. As I said at the beginning, we might think that religion would be the one area where foreign ideas and practices would have made little headway into Rome, given the highly traditional nature of Roman society. The very opposite was the truth. And the reason why foreign religious ideas and practices made headway into Rome had much to do with the nature of polytheism itself, which was constantly adapting itself to the changing social and political realities of the day. In addition, the Roman Empire was based on the principle of incorporation and inclusivity. It facilitated their dealings with other peoples to be respectful of those other people's gods. This wasn't mere religious opportunism. On the contrary, the Romans genuinely believed not only that they had much to learn from other people's religious constructions of the world, be they Etruscan, Greek, Egyptian, Celtic, or whatever, but also that the state actually benefited by incorporating their gods and the power which those gods brought with them. It was at moments of crisis, famine, plague, war, or civil unrest, that the Romans were most open to the importation of new cults. The earliest influence on Roman religion was Etruscan. Exactly when this began and ended is difficult to determine, but it probably fell within the final century of the monarchical period, since the last three kings of Rome, Tarquinius Priscus, Servius Tullius and Tarquinius Superbus, traditional dates 616 to 510 BC, were all Etruscan. One important Etruscan idea adopted by the Romans was that of the pomerium, a consecrated boundary line marked by stones which afforded the enclosed space divine protection. Likewise, a pit known as the mundus, which many Roman cities, including Rome, possessed, thought to provide access to the underworld, was a concept borrowed from the Etruscans. Tradition associates both features with Romulus, the first king of Rome, and that would date Etruscan influence to the middle of the 8th century, which seems highly unlikely. We should also note that three of Rome's most important deities, Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva, whose temple stood on the Capitol, were a specifically Etruscan triad or group of three. And last, it was the Etruscans who taught the Romans the art of haruspice, the art, that is, of examining the entrails of sacrificial animals, especially the liver, with a view to determining the future, as evidenced by the famous bronze sculpture of a liver dated circa 100 BC, which was found at Piacenza in northern Italy. We turn next to the influence of Greek religion. This was masterminded, or at least facilitated, by the Sibylline books. The books, that is, which contained the revelations of the Sibyls. A Sibyl was a Greek prophetess who served the god Apollo and delivered his revelations. Prophetess is perhaps not quite the right word. Mouthpiece or medium is better. The Sibylline books reached Rome from Cumae, a Greek colony, as we've seen, not far from Naples. They were a collection of oracular utterances composed in Greek hexameter verse, the same verse scheme used by Homer and Hesiod. They came to be housed in the temple of Jupiter Optimus Maximus, Jupiter best and greatest, on the Capitoline Hill. There's a marvellous story connected with their importation into Rome, and it tells us a great deal about the perceived relationship between the two religious systems. The Cumaean Sibyl is said to have offered the nine books to Tarquinius Priscus, Tarquin the Elder, traditionally 616 to 579 BC, Rome's fifth king, for a considerable sum of money. When Tarquin laughed, the Sibyl threw three of the books into the fire and offered him the remaining six at the same price. And when he laughed again, even more uproariously, she burnt three more. At this point, the king sat up and took notice and agreed to purchase the remaining three at the original asking price for the nine. It's highly revealing that the Romans should have preserved an anecdote that acknowledged their dependency on the Greeks. The Sibylline books constituted the principal conduit through which Greek religious practices entered Rome. They were in the care of a priestly college known as the Quindecimviri Sacris Faciundis, the 15 in charge of sacred matters, though they, and this is very important, could only be consulted at command of the Senate, which means that the Romans retained control over the degree to which Greek religion could influence their religious system. Their heyday, the period when they exercised most influence, was in the 3rd century BC, though they continued to be consulted as late as the 1st century AD. They supposedly remained fixed over time, though the collection on the Capitoline Hill was destroyed by fire in 83 BC and replaced by a new collection put together from surviving texts elsewhere. By the 1st century BC, the Sibylline books had begun to lose some of their hold over the Roman people, though we hear of a consultation as late as AD 536. I've already mentioned that it was a triad of Etruscan gods, Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva, who got pride of place on the Capitoline. However, the temple in which they were worshipped was very much designed on the Greek style by Tarquin the Proud, the last king of Rome, expelled in 510 BC. The first distinctively Greek gods began to enter the Roman pantheon at the beginning of the 5th century and, surprise, surprise, at the recommendation of the Sibylline books. The year was 496 BC, and this occurred in response to a famine. The books recommended the building of a temple to three Greek gods, namely Demeter, goddess of corn, her daughter Kore, and Dionysus, the god of wine. Well, not quite. They recommended a temple to Ceres, Libera, and Liber, the Roman equivalents of Demeter, Kore, and Dionysus. This, incidentally, was how the Greek gods consistently infiltrated the Roman citizen by being matched up with Roman gods. It's a phenomenon that we call syncretism. Syncretism made it easier for the ordinary Roman to accept the imported gods. Thus, Zeus got paired with Jupiter, so named for Zeus Pater, meaning Father Zeus. Greek Hera, his wife, got paired with Roman Juno. Greek Aphrodite, goddess of love and beauty, with Roman Venus. Greek Athena, goddess of women's crafts, with Roman Minerva. Greek Ares, god of war, with Roman Mars. Greek Hermes, the messenger god, with Roman Mercury. And Greek Hephaestus, god of the fire and metalwork, with Roman Vulcan, and so on. In the course of this process, some Roman deities were accorded a greater importance than they had possessed previously. The Roman Neptune, for instance, was in origin a river god who, by being assimilated to Poseidon, got promoted to the rank of sea god. The only god who was too Greek to be matched up with a Roman god was Apollon, Latin Apollo. That's why Apollo's temple was outside the Pomerium, the city boundary I mentioned earlier, and why, too, he was worshipped Graeco Ritu, in a particular Greek style. Apollo was the god of prophecy, and his sanctuary at Delphi in central Greece was the most important oracular sanctuary in the ancient world. In 394 BC, the Romans made a dedication at Delphi as a thank offering for their victory over the Etruscan city of Veii. It was probably the first time they acknowledged Delphi's authority. Why they did so at this date isn't entirely clear, but it may, in part, have been a way of placing themselves on the map, since the sanctuary at Delphi was chock full of dedications by leading Greek communities, and now Rome was joining them. It wasn't until the period of Augustus, however, in the final decades of the first century BC, that Apollo became thoroughly integrated into Roman religious life. Augustus made Apollo his special protector, partly in response to the fact that his rival, Mark Antony, adopted Dionysus, otherwise known as Bacchus, the god of wine and ecstatic liberation. As I said earlier, it was at times of crisis that the Romans were most likely to introduce new gods and new rituals. A critical year was 399 BC, when A, a deadly epidemic broke out, and when B, the Romans were pressing hard to take the Etruscan town of Veii. So they introduced a ritual known as the Lectisternium to elicit the goodwill of the Greek gods. A Lectisternium, the meaning is spreading of the couch, involved placing images of the gods on couches and offering them a sacred meal. The belief was that the gods were being invited into the city to dine. Livy describes its first occurrence in Rome, which was accompanied by a mood of general rejoicing. He writes, "Throughout the city, doors were flung open and everything was made available. Everyone was treated hospitably, friends and strangers alike, and people had affable intercourse with enemies even. There were no quarrels or lawsuits. Even prisoners had their chains taken off, and afterwards it was not thought right to chain up the people whom the gods had assisted in this way." The third century heralded a new era of imported cults, perhaps masterminded by the Sibylline books, though again at the request of the Senate. In 293, when Rome was again suffering from a severe pestilence, the Sibylline books recommended the introduction of the healing god Aesculapius, Greek Asclepius, from Epidaurus in the northeast Peloponnese. An embassy of 10 Romans sailed to Epidaurus. They were apparently greeted by a sacred snake, which they transported on board ship back to Rome with all due pomp and ceremony. As they were sailing back up the Tiber, the snake slipped overboard and took up residence on the island in the Tiber. A temple was established on the island, and not long afterwards, the pestilence abated. When the Second Punic War broke out in 218, the war against the Carthaginians under Hannibal, the Romans went into panic mode. After their defeat at the Battle of Lake Trasimene in northern Italy in 217, they introduced a number of innovations, again on the recommendation of the Sibylline books. First, all formal distinction between Greek and Roman gods was now officially annulled. The Greek gods, in other words, were placed on a par with the Roman gods, or rather, their identities completely merged. Second, they vowed a temple to Venus Erixina, Venus of Eryx. Eryx was a city in northwestern Sicily, on the Capitoline Hill, the most prestigious religious site in Rome. Venus Erixina thus became the first foreign deity to be worshipped inside the Pomerium. The Romans may well have feared that Sicily would defect to the Carthaginians, and so they introduced the goddess to mollify its people. I don't mean they did that cynically, but that would have been the expected outcome. Then, after their defeat at the Battle of Cannae in 216, the Romans again became so apprehensive that the gods had abandoned them that they performed human sacrifice. They'd done so once before in 228 BC, around the time of the First Illyrian War. On each occasion, two Gauls and two Greeks were sacrificed. Why they chose Gauls and Greeks isn't clear. Normally, the Romans abhorred human sacrifice, so this is a sign of how panic-stricken they were. Finally, towards the end of the Second Punic War in 205, the cult of the Oriental goddess Cybele, the mother of all things, was introduced into Rome from Pessinus, modern Balikhisar in Turkey, 80 miles southwest of Ankara. By Oriental, I mean Eastern in the sense of being not purely Greek and therefore given to more extreme forms of religious expression in the Roman viewpoint. Livy tells us exactly why the Romans brought her in. He writes, "In order to gain all the sooner the victory which the fates, the omens, and the oracles were pointing to, the Romans began to plan for the best way of bringing the goddess to Rome." In other words, the Romans needed the support of Pergamum, under whose auspices the cult entered Rome, in the expectation that its king Attalus would, I quote from Livy, "do all he could in the interest of the Roman people." Even so, the Senate eliminated any whiff of Oriental excess. Cybele was given a Roman name, Magna Mater, the Great Mother, and her arrival in Rome, as Livy describes it, was a stately affair. Cybele, the Magna Mater, was the last Greek or quasi-Greek deity to be introduced into Rome. Significantly, this event coincided with Rome's defeat of Carthage, which followed a few years later. Never again would Rome's very survival be threatened as it had been by Hannibal. The gods had done their work. Another practice that the Romans adopted from the Greeks was the worship of abstract forces and ideals. From the 4th century BC onwards, Tuke, the personification of fortune, was worshipped by the Greeks. And other forces, such as Irene, peace, began to receive cult. The first abstraction to be worshipped in Rome was Concordia, civil harmony, which was introduced in 367 BC when the patricians conceded certain important rights to the plebeians, including the right to serve as consuls. In later times, notably from the Principate onwards, the cult of Concordia would become popular throughout the empire as an expression of Rome's relations with her allies. The goddess was frequently depicted in art, notably in coinage, as a sedate, matronly figure. Other abstractions that were deified by the Romans include virtus, manly courage, fides, faithfulness, libertas, liberty, and pietas, particularly Roman virtue, piety. It wasn't just the Olympian deities that the Romans accommodated. Early on, too, they must have come into contact with quasi-religious groups, known today as the Pythagoreans and Orphics, who transmitted to the Romans their belief in reincarnation, or more accurately, their belief in metempsychosis, the transfer of the soul from one body to another. The Pythagoreans were so named for Pythagoras, a religious charismatic born on the island of Samos, who set himself up in Croton in southern Italy around 530 BC. And the Orphics for Orpheus, the mythical singer who brought back his wife Eurydice from Hades. Yet another branch of religion in which the Greeks exercised a dominant influence was astrology, the art, or is it a science? The Greeks certainly thought so, of converting astronomical data about the positions of celestial bodies into predictive data about the progress of human affairs. I say science because the Greeks didn't acknowledge any hard and fast distinction between astrology and astronomy, something that we'll talk about later in our lecture on science and technology. Despite all that the Greeks contributed to Roman religion, we shouldn't for one moment suppose that their contribution overwhelmed what was distinctive about Roman religion. That was never the Roman way. For a start, despite the fact that the Greeks taught the Romans to think of their gods anthropomorphically, it's unlikely that this ever took quite the same hold on the Roman imagination as it did on the Greek. That's one of the reasons, I think, why there are relatively few homegrown Roman myths. As a result, the Romans probably never felt much closeness to the gods, though they did at times find it convenient to claim descent from them, as most conspicuously perhaps in the case of Julius Caesar, who traced his descent back to Venus. Nor did the Romans take over Greek practices wholesale. Rather, they adapted them to their taste. They sanitized what they imported. For instance, they didn't allow temple prostitutes into Rome, although these were part of the Sicilian cult of Venus Erycina. And they didn't allow castrated priests to practice in Rome either, although these were part of the Oriental cult of Cybele. There were other important differences between the two religious systems. First, ethical behavior was more closely linked to the Roman religious system than was the case among the Greeks. Think of that quintessential quality pietas, as exemplified, even personified by Aeneas, the duty that was owed to the gods, to one's parents, to the dead, and one's native land. Though the equivalent virtue did exist among the Greeks, the word was eusebeia, it didn't resonate quite so forcefully. Virtue for the Greeks was more the preserve of philosophy. Though once Greek philosophy began to make headway in Roman society, educated Romans also used that medium to debate moral values. Neither society, however, came anywhere close to imposing a standard of conduct in the name of religion, in the way that Christianity, Judaism, and Islam do. Second, the dead. The Roman dead were a much more powerful presence in the lives of the living than were their Greek counterparts. As lares, or deified ancestors, a very rough translation, they were worshipped among the household gods. Other household gods were the penates, who ensured that there was enough food to eat. And they even had their own special shrine in the house, known as a lararium. The dead took other forms as well. There were the maiores, the greater ones, meaning the dead in general. The mos maiorum, an almost untranslatable concept that means something akin to traditional practice as established by the dead, acted as an important incentive or disincentive in all sorts of areas of life. Third, to adapt Clausewitz's famous dictum about war being a continuation of politics by other means, for the Romans, religion was a continuation of politics by other means. Nothing proves this better than the career of Julius Caesar, elected Pontifex Maximus in 63 BC, a man who probably believed in nothing other than his own genius, and in fortuna, and who certainly exploited his position for his own political advantage. Though once again, it's dangerous to generalize, we know of no priest or priestly official in the Greek world who came anywhere close to wielding the same political influence as he did in this capacity. To conclude, religion is just one area, albeit one of the most important, in which Rome's contact with the Greeks led to a profound reinterpretation of her way of seeing the world. From 217 BC onwards, the Roman religious system became fairly settled for about two centuries, although it underwent further profound change, as we'll see in a later lecture on religion, when the Roman emperors adopted ruler cult from the Greeks. In the next lecture, we're going to return to our historical narrative, which we can now situate against the background of an emerging Greco-Roman identity. And we return to our narrative just when the relationship between the two cultures starts to take a very dark turn.